Thank you, Carolyn. My name is Paul Soniette. I'm the director of the Botanical Garden, and I've been there for about 33 years now. I was just very, very young when I started. And it's actually a very small garden, and what I'm going to talk about today is give you a little bit of background on the garden, when it was originally built, and then it fell into disrepair, and then we had a grassroots real movement to try to revitalize it, build it, and then the effects of Katrina and where we are today. And this is a slide of the original garden back in 1932, and it was a project of the WPA, which was Works Progress Administration, that was developed after the Depression to try to put a lot of people to work. And the great thing about that, the WPA in the garden in City Park, is our garden is very small in relatively terms. It's about 12 acres, and City Park is about 1,350 acres. So we're just a real small part of a larger park. But the WPA came in and reworked roads and bridges and dug lagoons, built stadiums, and did all sorts of things in that period of time. And but at the time this garden was built, it was simply known as the Rose Garden. It didn't have any buildings per se. It didn't have any fences. It was just a place where people could go and recreate and enjoy a garden without any admission fee and that kind of thing. And these are some early shots of the garden with the hedges. That's a, I believe the best I could tell is Japanese yew hedges and a lily pond, some irises and so forth. It was very formal. It was divided into rooms, mainly about five rooms with roses. And if you looked at the plant palette, there was probably, you know, maybe about 15, 20 plants, roses, camellias, azaleas, sweet olives, things like that. So it really wasn't a good variety of plants. This is another picture of the same area, some of the sculptures. And that was done by this sculptor, Enrique Alferez, who is a Mexican-born sculptor that did the work in the 1930s. And now this is a picture when I got there in 1982, and you can see, if you look before, these hedges were all encompassing the garden. But again, this garden at the time in the early 80s was open to the public, didn't have any fences, and people would go in there and do all sorts of bad things. So they said, well, let's trim up these hedges and so nobody can hide behind them and hurt anybody. So when I got there, these Japanese yews were trimmed up. And if you know a lot with the conifers, they don't really break very much at the bottom after you trim them up like that. So we had to eventually pull them all out. But it really, you know, a garden is unless you maintain it, it just doesn't exist anymore. It deteriorates very rapidly, especially in our climate with the heat and humidity. But you can see here we have a picture of what it was, and there was a slide early with all the hedges. So all the hedges were gone. The only thing really left it in that time, this was like 82, was some of the large oak trees. On the left is a large live oak. Some of the camellias and a building called the potting shed. But we did have the sculpture, which was very important to us. And in 1982, they formed a group of people called the Friends of City Park that said, well, look, we've got to find a way to protect this garden. And the truth is, there was a lot of discussion, well, was it even worth saving? And if it wasn't really for the sculpture, they probably would not have saved it or not really refurbished it as a garden, because there wasn't any much of a garden there. But the sculpture was there, and luckily it was mostly intact at the time. So in 1982, they brought back the sculptor, which is Enrique Alferez, which is on your left, when his wife is on the far right. And he refurbished some of the fountains and got everything going, and that's some of his work. And he was a really interesting guy, and I'll talk a little bit later about him. He was a pure artist. He just loved his work, and he lived to be about 98, and he kept working right up until his death. And in 1982, again, you know, we've never had much money, and we had a lot of volunteers that came in and donated money and plants, and this is a local garden club that planted some hedges. And this is, some of you all might know Dan Gill, and he's a local agent. Well, this is about 30 years ago when Dan was a lot younger, so was I. And at the time, we had very little staff, and Dan was just starting as an ag agent. And he would come every Tuesday and direct a group of volunteers. So with him there, it gave us a real focus for volunteer groups, and that really has helped us to this day. We still have volunteers on a Tuesday that come, and at the time we probably would have about 20 to 25 volunteers every Tuesday because Dan was there. And this is a slide probably about 3 years, 4 years after I was there. But, you know, we were working off a plan that really wasn't an original plan. And the original slide I showed you, like here, with the lily pond and showing the hedges, they changed it to roses. But after we planted them and through the years, we said, well, we really should go back to what it was. And after a while, we pulled out the roses and planted the hedges back. But we tried to start some education programs, and at the time we didn't have an education director, so we just had volunteers doing that. And this was mainly, we started with doing school tours for children, create a small butterfly garden. But you know, we got to a point where we really needed a plan, and we developed a plan for the garden. This was probably done in about 1987. And at the time, you know, they gave me the garden, they put a fence around it and basically said good luck. And I was hired for 5 years, and we were getting toward the end of the 5 years. And so I said, well, we need a plan, and we need a building, we need an entrance. At the time we had no way for people to come to an entrance, pay admission, there was no gift shop, there was no source of revenue to do rentals and things. So in the bottom right, there's a pavilion. That's the new entrance now. And that gave us the ability to do big lectures, have rentals and things like that, because City Park, even though its name is City Park, only receives about less than 30% of its funds from from the public. So everything else is either money that we have to generate ourselves or donations. So it can be a real tough existence at times. And this is the Garden Study Center, which was the only building on the site, and it was renovated. This was originally a head house for the greenhouse, but we renovated it because we needed a place for classrooms and things like that. So we did this. And this is the pavilion, which is our entrance now. And we use this. We probably have maybe 300 events in here a year. And it's a beautiful building. It functions very well. We wanted to design it to look like an orangery, where it would sit low in the garden, have a lot of windows where people could look out into the garden. And it also, the way it's situated between axes, people can come and walk through the garden and not go into the building, but they can still visit the garden. And also we wanted to put a new sculpture in, and this was also Enrique Alfaro's, his last big sculpture. This was done when he was about 97 years old. He created this bronze sculpture, and this is another one of his here. And after we built the pavilion, we had such a great axis, a focal point on one axis, we needed something on the other. So we came up with a design to take an old greenhouse and put a dome on it. So we had, like I said, a gazebo on one side, and then we did the conservatory on the other side. And the greenhouse itself is not that much bigger. We just added this central dome, and we hope in the next 3 to 4 years to be able to build onto the back of it and have larger collections and have a bigger greenhouse. And a little bit in the greenhouse, we have two wings, and one of them was called for living fossils. Did any of you all go to the garden on Monday? I know there was some people went Monday. This is just a small exhibit where we wanted to showcase plants before flowering plants. So we have real fossils mixed in with things like cycads and ferns and lycopods and Selaginellas. And on the other side is more of a generic or general rainforest. And, you know, it's impossible to recreate the rainforest, but we tried to mix some of the plants that were horticulturally attractive but had some kind of story to tell when we go through the garden. And we built different gardens, and this is a vegetable garden that we designed because we really didn't have a vegetable garden. And the two little buildings, this one here was actually a starter house on the golf course in City Park. But again, most of the park was developed in the WPA, and a lot of it was done by the same architect. So this little gazebo, a little building, was a starter house on the golf course, but it had the same bricks and it had the same slate, and it was designed by the same architect as our building. So we moved two of these from another part of the park, put them there, and then basically built the garden around it. And this is an old sugar kettle that someone from one of the families had a plantation up the river donated it. And it's years ago they used to boil the sugar cane in that and make molasses. And that was probably about 150 years old. And we have a small little Japanese garden. And we had just done that garden. And we renovated an old, we call it a stove house because it was a little greenhouse that had heat. And this would have been like 2000, maybe 4, early 5, right before Katrina. And someone had donated a cactus and succulent collection to us. But this is a picture that someone took a few days after Katrina. So that shows you the conservatory where we just saw the living fossils. And in the top of the screen is the pavilion. And you can see all the water around in the garden, and it was pretty much everything was gone. This is Tad Gormley Stadium, which is right behind the Botanical Garden, probably a couple thousand yards behind us. And the way things are in New Orleans, the highest grounds that you have is by the rivers. Like where we are, Mississippi River is probably three blocks to the right, to my right over here. And as you know, in history, before they built the levees, when the rivers would overflow, they would build up their banks with alluvial deposits on either side of the river, and that was the same with some of these bayous in the city. So that was the high ground, but if you go to the middle of the city, it's like a bowl, and that's where all the lowland is. And City Park is right on the edge. There's a bayou right to our, that would be to our south, where it's right at sea level. And our garden was about 2 feet below sea level. This stadium is probably about 3 feet. As you went back to the back of the park, it was more like 8 feet. So depending where you are in the park, the water just got worse and worse. And this is a picture of New Orleans Museum of Art coming up to the front. And, you know, it was pretty chaotic during that time. The National Guard had closed all of the entrances to the park and used the museum as headquarters. And I had called somebody who had gotten the National Guard in, and she was supposed to meet me at the museum, but she wasn't there, and I went up to the guards and they wouldn't let me in. So I kind of snuck around the back through another gate and came in because I wanted to go to the Botanical Garden and see what it looked like. And all of a sudden, on this Jeep pulls up all these National Guards with machine guns, asked me what I'm doing there, and I said, I'm just taking pictures. But they followed me all through the buildings, and then kind of escorted me out. But this is some of the trees and so forth in the garden. And in our building, we had a lot of, we use it for a lot of wedding receptions, and that particular weekend, we had an event on Friday night, we had one on Saturday, and we were scheduled to have one on Sunday. And everything was set up for a function on Sunday, but everybody, you know, the mayor called for mandatory evacuation, so everybody left on Sunday. So there was no event that happened on Sunday, but all of these tables and chairs and everything was set up with bars and so forth when we got there. This is about 30 days, about maybe 3 weeks after Katrina when we finally got back in. But it was interesting, and if you see all these tables lined up, that's not for a wedding. What would happen, the National Guard would come in and line up the tables and have their MREs right there in the pavilion. So they adapted the space to their use. And but it was really kind of eerie when you walk back in and saw all these things set up. And, you know, all the bar mixers and everything still there. And there was a wedding cake that never really got cut because, like I said, that wedding didn't happen. And it was really kind of nasty, the groom's cake and then the bride's cake. And these are some pictures that show you what it looked like before. So this is the Rose Garden on the left and then after Katrina on the right. And, you know, some of the plant material that made it were most things that were native to floodplains. The pines in the back are slash pines, I think. But things like magnolia, camellias, azaleas, anything that really grows natively in well-drained soils just didn't survive. But things like live oaks, sweet bays, water oaks, cypress, palms, bananas, even crepe myrtles were really tough. They survived. But just about all the perennials, all the shrubs, everything else that was gone. But luckily, you know, live oaks are pretty tolerant species. If you look at a live oak, you see how they're built, and they're built low to the ground. They're really horizontal. They can take a lot of wind. And most of them, they'll take water, you know, because they're used to being in areas that'll flood periodically. They won't live in areas that are completely wet all the time. But when you go through South Louisiana, if you see areas that are elevated even 2 or 3 feet above the water line, you'll see live oaks develop and grow and little chenilles. And this is a little bit after the storm, after we replanted. Oh, that was before, and this is after. So this is just some of the views, all of the things that we were greeted with. You know, and it was kind of interesting that, you know, getting there in 1982 and there was really nothing there, and then coming back in 2005 and kind of starting all over again. But on the other hand, you kind of corrected some mistakes you made when you did it the first time. But luckily, we had a donor that had pledged some money for a conservatory expansion the year before. It was $1 million, and when Katrina hit, the donor said, well, let's go ahead and make that money available. And if that wouldn't have happened, I don't think, there's no way that we could have turned that garden around so fast. And it probably would have recovered, but it would have been much slower, and most of my staff probably wouldn't be there. I probably wouldn't be there. And these are some, we have greenhouses in the back of the park. Now back here, the water was probably about 6 feet deep. And she's pointing to about 5 feet, about where she's pointing where the water line was. And one of the interesting things is that because we had a donor that gave us money, we just went ahead and started doing things. It was private money. It wasn't government money, so we didn't have to publicly bid anything. But because we did that, we forfeited any reimbursement from FEMA on things that we did do. But it was still the best thing to do because we got things up and running right away. But it was interesting in that FEMA did not cover any collections, any plant material growing out in the botanical garden. They considered that landscape. And they did not, when you did a project worksheet, you could do it for buildings, but they would not cover anything for landscapes. So all of the, even if you said, well, these are botanical garden collections and their accession, it didn't matter. But what they did cover was all the plants in our greenhouse, because we have a lot of plant sales, and we said, well, that's inventory. So they had a slot in their government list of what they would cover, and one of those slots was inventory. And so we were able to get a lot of reimbursement for plant material. And the same thing with our buildings. Now, a lot of the buildings, this is actually, that was my office. And again, we went in quickly and renovated this, and we didn't get any recovery money for that. But again, we were in that building probably about 2 months after Katrina. And you know, one of the interesting things, I'd never gone through something this big before, and that when all of this happened, there was just so much devastation and people coming into the city, people were setting up tents and living in City Park. And, you know, this was all new to us. So eventually the park, and at the time had no incomes coming in. Like I said, we didn't have any kind of tax base. So they started organizing the tent people and started charging them rent. And that was one of the only ways we were able to pay for our staff. But we had to hire people to go collect the rent, which wasn't a very pleasant thing. And this is some more in the office building. Now, we started working on the buildings, and this probably was around maybe September, October, probably October of 2005. And we had some pre-existing conditions and some damage to that building because of the way it was built, which had some rot. And we said, well, look, this is an opportunity to try to fix what we had wrong and do it right. So we re-poured the terraces because the terraces were not level. So that gave us an opportunity to do that. But this building only had about 6 inches of water, so we didn't have to completely take care, you know, take all the sheetrock off and so forth. But we were back open in April of 2007. And again, like I said, we repaired these buildings quickly, so we didn't get reimbursed. But again, we did get reimbursed for the library books because we did have them mostly cataloged and we could provide them with a list of books. So we did get reimbursed for that. And I think that we're probably one of the only gardens in the universe where their hedges were planted by National Guard troops. Because, you know, a few blocks, well, about 5 blocks away is the river, Rivergate, which is a convention center and so forth. And that's where the National Guard was stationed. And again, you know, we were looking for volunteers, and I remember going down there and trying to recruit National Guardsmen to come help us. And sometimes we were able to do that, sometimes not. And this group, I think they were from North Louisiana or Mississippi, came in and, you know, they thought they'd have it easy planting plants. Well, these were bald and burlap Japanese yews, and they were a little bit of a challenge. But they got them all done. And then finally we were able to bring back some of our staff. And just a lot of volunteers came in. People from the city, people from out of the city came in and started helping us plant plants. And we had to do all the electrical over. Any electrical in the garden had to be redone. And one of the things that we've been doing since 1987 was a big holiday celebration. And, you know, at the time, there was no electricity to this part of the city. Everything was down. But we convinced the energy company to get us some energy. And it was kind of a political problem because a lot of people didn't have energy, didn't have electricity at the time. But we wanted to have this event, and we were able to pull that off in, I think, the second week of December. And but this is showing some of the new planting right after we finished in the conservatory. And it was interesting in the conservatory because everything was closed up. It got so hot in there, everything that was high in the greenhouse burnt up. Everything that was low in the greenhouse drowned. So we had like a little layer of life in the middle section of the greenhouse. But again, like I said, we were able to open up for Christmas that year. And it was really, really a phenomenal event because you would have to drive through the city, and there was darkness everywhere. And then you'd come to the garden. and see all these lights. And it was the first time people got to see each other in a while. And so we were able to slowly get back together. And, you know, for the first year and a half, we just opened the garden. We didn't really charge an admission. We were able to get a tent from this donor that we used for the Christmas event. But then we opened it up. We had art markets. We were trying to do anything we could to get people in the garden. And we also had a group from the Brooklyn Botanical Garden came down and helped us plant a lot of beds. And we finally reopened the pavilion back in, like I said, April. And these are more recent shots, things we've done, created a new shade garden back in the back of the garden. This is a little volunteer pavilion built probably about 2007. And we built the stage because we were trying to do things and bring music to the garden. So that was built with funds from a donor probably in about 2008. And this is a little bit of a graph. Now, this is city park staff. The garden staff at the time was about 8 people, including our gift shop and education. But if you look at 2004, there were 118 people working in City Park, and then it went down to 26. And of the 26, about 8 of them were botanical garden workers, and the other ones were maybe director of human resources or PR, all the park directors, the executive director, chief financial officer. And the park itself really only had funds to fund the staff, even at that 26 number till about December. And but because we had this donor, we were able to get the pavilion open. We were able to, and the park itself got the driving range open, and we started charging for, like I said, the guys living in tents. And then slowly but surely, we were able to get enough money to start hiring people back. And now we're up to about 112, and probably maybe more than that now. And to give you an idea of the funding, City Park, again, which we are part of, receives only 14% of its funds through public money. So 86% is privately funded or money that we self-generate, either through rentals, plant sales. We have an amusement area that charges. We have a full catering service. So it's really, really a struggle at time, and we hope eventually to get some kind of public funding. But that compares with an average U.S. park where public funds are around 65% and self-generated funds are at 35%. And this shows you an interesting pattern of growth. And, you know, I mentioned originally that our garden was built in the WPA. And again, at that time, in the 1930s, the park had no money, but luckily they had a plan, and they had a master plan that they developed probably about a year before they started the WPA. And that first increase around 1935 is all of the developments with the WPA, with the stadiums and the bridges and the building of the garden, the golf courses and all of that. But then, again, in about 1980s, all of that stuff was deteriorating and declining. So the park itself, you know, what was in decline, and then Katrina hit, and it brought it to the bottom. And now we're on a tremendous upswing. Since Katrina, I don't know the exact number, but I think about $120 million has gone into City Park through private and public funds, and we've closed some golf courses. We've opened up more green space. We've done a lot of things. We've created a dog park. There's a mini golf. There's some festival grounds for big festivals. And it's really probably the best it's ever been. But one of the challenges is to find a way to get some kind of public support. So 10 years from now, that doesn't start to decline just like it did after the WPA. And this is just some of the FEMA money. This is an older slide, but I think we've gotten about $33 million in FEMA, and the golf course is not in, so it's probably around $40 million from FEMA. But FEMA is an interesting body to fool with. You know, when Katrina hit, they had certain rules and regulations that just didn't work for Katrina. And we had people that came in, and they were here a whole year trying to work with us, do project worksheets, and they basically, after a year, they threw out all of what we've done and rewrote the rules, and the rules were rewritten for our benefit. I mean, they were a little more liberal, but basically you wasted a whole year. And it's unless you know the rules, and those rules change all the time, it's really a difficult process to go through. And right now we're in the process of constructing a new entrance, because over the years we've done a lot of development on the side opposite where our existing entrance is. And if you'd go out there right now, there's a construction fence around this building, and it'll be an entrance to the garden and Storyland, which is our children's amusement area right next door. And we'll have a new arrival garden. This will be the first thing you see as you walk in. And we're working on a new sculpture garden honoring Enrique Alfaro. So we've taken, in addition to the pieces that we have in the garden, we have a donor that's purchased about 14 additional pieces, and we hope to have this open in October of this year. Really excited. It's not going to be very big, but it's going to be a really exciting garden. And that's the back end of construction. That was taken just a few days ago. That's going to be our new gift shop, and that's a scene from the garden. And this is a picture of a relief of one of the bridges. Like I said, in the 1930s, the sculptor Alferez did a lot of work on the bridges. So we made some molds of the bridges and made casts and brought them in to the garden, and that's going to be part of the entry garden. And so I think we've come a long way, and we're probably a lot better than we are before, but we're still in the master planning process, and hopefully in the next few years we'll be able to expand our conservatory and eventually one day take up some property on the other side behind us and expand some wildflower areas and some other things. So thank you very much, and hopefully you'll be able to visit us while you're here. If anybody has any questions or... Yes, ma'am.
So it's an amazing recovery, and I'm thrilled to see how beautiful it is, but I'm just wondering what you may have done differently this time. You know, you're still below sea level. What if this happens again?
Well, you know, the reality with New Orleans, and that was a big problem when people rebuilt. You know, we knew where that water line was, and it was probably, if you were standing here, it was about 3 feet, but if you stand where I live in Lakeview, which is a mile from here, it was probably 8 feet. So then do you build at 9 feet, or do you try to rely on the protection of the levees, and hopefully they won't break again? And the thing with the plant material, we do have to plant high, because our ground is really, it's a heavy clay, so you have to plant high. But the reality is, if we get another break in the levees, it's going to flood again, you know, because, and it's interesting, if you look at a map of New Orleans, and if you see the areas that flooded, it's all the areas that were developed probably past 1890, say 1910 maybe, when all of the levee systems and the pumping stations were put in right at the turn of the century. So they drained that bowl in the middle of New Orleans, and they said, okay, everybody, y'all can move in. So as a homeowner, I built a house after Katrina, and I was debating, you know, do I build it up that high, or do I build where FEMA will protect you, well, where FEMA, where you can get flood insurance. And most people, you know, do you want to walk up 20 feet every time you go into your home, you know? And so I guess, you know, the reality is, even if I would be high and dry and everybody else flooded, you wouldn't want to be there anyway. So I ended up just building it at the FEMA elevation, which is about 4 feet off the ground. And, I mean, we did raise our beds. We improved electrical and things like that. But, you know, there's only so much, I guess, you can do. But there's a lot of buildings and construction that they don't put generators in basements anymore. I mean, a lot of these office buildings downtown, all their communications systems, their generators, all of their technical things were in the basements. And any new construction, they don't do that anymore, you know, so. Well, thank y'all. I'm sorry.
Do you have a list of the plants that survive?
Would
you recommend that would tolerate flooding?
Well, I had mentioned that any of the plants that are native to floodplains, so anything like water oaks, live oaks, sweet gums, things, I guess it was easier saying what, well, I guess the things that made it were palms, bamboo, some of the gingers made it, not all of them. Crepe myrtles were pretty tough. But things that didn't make it, azaleas, camellias, magnolias. The magnolias, even a little bit of water would damage them. I don't know if we ever produced a real list, because during that time we were just so busy. But generally, things that are native to floodplains survived. Most of the native holly survived also, you know, cypress, things like that. Well, thank you all.